Hi, this is Dee Dee of Brown Girls Booking. As a reminder, we upload every Wednesday or every other week or bi-weekly. We'd like to thank you for listening, and if you love the show, please follow our social media. We can be found at Brown Girls Booking on Instagram and Facebook. We also have a Patreon, and your support helps us with our production costs, which we appreciate. We hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, I'm Dee Dee.
And I'm Christy, and we are Brown Girls Booking.
And this is the show from two readers looking for known and unknown narratives in familiar and unfamiliar spaces.
We're two girls reading literary fiction widely. If there's a topic or theme that's been written about, then it's a topic or theme we want to talk about. And today, we are talking about Nightwood by Djuna Barnes, written in the 1930s, and well,
yeah.
I did not enjoy this book.
I don't know. Well, you see, look, I remember when I had joined BookTube, I think in 2013, and I distinctly remember this book was going around everywhere on BookTube. That is on the adult side of BookTube. And I just, yeah. I kept watching, you know, people say, oh, I'm reading Nightwood by Djuna Barnes, and oh, it's so good. And I just remember all this raving and stuff. But there was just something about the description of the book or the way that people were talking about the book that just did not grab me and pull me in. So I was always like, nah, I'm not going to do that. And I think I should have listened to my instinct on this one because it's really not my cup of tea. But, you know, like I know that it is a example of modernist literature.
Yes.
Of the time. But also it's tagged as one of the beginning lesbian novels.
Yes.
Now, just because these two things are true, in my opinion, doesn't mean that, you know, we have to just say, oh, it's fun. It's fantastic. It's fantastic. I just had a problem with the way she goes about telling the story and the way she writes. Now, if I'm not mistaken, I read that T.S. Eliot was praising this book because of the language.
Did he edit it?
I don't think he edited it, but he said a novel which only sensibilities trained on poetry can wholly appreciate. That's what he says about Nightwood. And there's some other stuff about him praising the language. Now, I found the language to be confusing at times because
yeah.
I wasn't really sure what was the point of what she was saying and actually what did it mean. It's not very clear some things.
For me, one of the things that was at turns compelling and repellent was the fact that the language read so beautifully and then was so dense. Mm-hmm. And I am a big proponent of the reader doing work. I just felt like sometimes when I was reading this book, I was like, you could have ended the sentence here, but you went on mm-hmm. for four or five more flourishes. So sometimes the language was a little too purple for me, but that's an aesthetic, right? And so that's why I led with the fact that I did not enjoy this book. And I also have to lead with the fact that I tend not to like modernist fiction.
No.
And I also tend not to like metafiction. And I would classify this as metafiction. And I think other people have. And
maybe you want to give your definition of metafiction in case there's people out here that don't know what that means.
So for me, metafiction is fiction that calls back on itself. There's a constant reminder through a character or through the structure of the writing mm-hmm. that the reader is reading fiction.
Yeah.
So the suspense of belief doesn't typically happen because the writing is always reminding you that you're reading metafiction. It affects me in the same way that breaking down the third wall in theater affects me. And it's not that I don't think that it can't be done and it shouldn't be done. But for me, because it's not my aesthetic, you have to do it so well. And different writers do it in different ways, right? I love The Brief and Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde by Juno Diaz, yeah. for better or for worse.
Yeah.
That could be considered metafiction. All of those footnotes in the book reminds you at all times that you are reading a construct in some way, shape, or form.
Absolutely.
But I was wholly consumed by it. The other thing that I'm deeply aware of in reading Juno Barnes's book is, while we follow a cast of characters who are undeniably on the fringe and undeniably marginalized and minoritized in certain ways, whether it's because of their ethnicity or their finances or their sexuality, it is a cast of minoritized and marginalized characters with identities that I don't actually plug into and relate to. Yeah. And so I have to ask myself, is this not enjoyable for me because it's not enjoyable? Because the writing in and of itself is, for me, obscure. That's what I found at some places. Or is it not enjoyable because I can't relate to most of the characters in the book? And I think the answer is yes to both of those.
I feel like the characters were eluding. They were drifting away to a certain extent because these characters had no basis for me. And that's when I got really worried because I was like, how am I reading this book? And I can't even imagine what Robin looks like. And she's the main freaking character. I can't even tell you if she's brunette, blonde, redhead, or what. I don't know anything. I can't imagine anything about the characters. I was like, what kind of book am I reading here? And I feel like that has a lot to do with not relating to the characters. And it's not even not relating because, I mean, of course, I'm very different from the characters in the book, but that doesn't usually deter me from trying to understand their story. Now, to get back to your definition of metafiction, I've looked it up. It says metafiction, fiction in which the author self-consciously alludes to the artificiality or literariness of a work by parodying or departing from novelistic conventions and traditional narrative techniques, which is pretty much what you get in this book. And that's one of the main things was the characters have distinct personalities, but there seems to be always something that would deter me from trying to get to understanding these characters a bit more. For some reason, I was like distracted by that.
So I would say, yeah, I was definitely distracted. And I would say this book is why I would encourage anybody to read books that they may actually know that they won't enjoy or that would put them in unfamiliar territory, because I know about myself, right? This helped me re-solidify my reader profile.
Yeah.
I know about myself that I don't like what I term the novel of erudition. And for me, what the novel of erudition looks like is it tends to be steeped in theory,
yeah,
philosophy. There can be a lot of postulation. There are moments in the novel that can read like a play. And I know that about myself, that kind of erudition in a novel is not what I like. I prefer to get that in my academic, where there's an academic outcome. That being said, if you are that kind of reader,
yeah, you might like this one.
This book is very much for you. So we follow a cast of characters who are on the fringe.
They refuse to openly be who they really are.
Everybody in this novel obfuscates. Everybody in this novel is wearing a multiplicity of masks.
Of masks, yeah.
And I think the point of that for Juno Barnes is a commentary on society and the masks that we choose to wear, have to wear due to societal constructs and due to the constraints that we put on our own selves.
It is the 1930s.
It is the 1930s.
We're at the point where Hitler is rising.
Yes.
And so people are starting to look at each other with a side eye, like, who is that? Like,
yes.
Should I be with this person? And for me, the two main themes were that I managed to understand while reading this is there's a big discussion, more philosophical than anything else, on the Jews and Protestants.
The Judaism and Christianity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is a narrative. And then when Juno Barnes writes about Christianity in this novel, the conversation between Christianity is between Protestants and Catholics.
And Catholics, exactly. Well, because we have the two characters, we have Felix, he calls himself a baron when he isn't one.
No, he's not.
Of Jewish faith. And yes. He has a friend, Matthew, who is Irish and who is of
probably Catholic faith.
Yeah, I think he's Catholic, if I remember correctly. So they often have these discussions, regular discussions, about the difference between Jews and Christians. And
yes,
so
yes.
What you read into that is often this idea of mistrust and stereotypical ideas that people have about both. And at the moment, how it's uncomfortable for Felix to be anything else other than this Baron that he really isn't.
Right.
Because it saves him and protects him from anything he can't see coming his way.
It's a moniker too that he adopts that's inherited from his father. Because father was the first one who made a conscious decision to pretend to be a Baron during the First World War. So of course it made sense to have the mask of class that can transcend certain atrocities. And so Felix then too takes up the mantle that his father, who dies 6 months before he is born, has carried.
His mother right after she births him.
Right. And Felix is, I would argue, of the cast of characters that we look at, the one with the most obvious mask. And I thought about the progression of the ways in which the characters are multi-layered. So we meet Felix and then we meet the doctor himself has his own set of identities that in the 1930s are not permissible.
No.
Right? And he is incredibly insightful. I would say that the doctor almost acts like a Greek chorus.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, because he's sort of like that reminder of, hey, it's like this.
And the doctor comes out and eventually admits after being caught by another character dressed up as a woman that he wanted to be a woman.
Yes.
And he's talking about the cruelty of life. And he was saying, look, we're given what we're given. And if I had had what I wanted, I would have actually been somebody with a high bosom and blonde curls, pushing out a baby every 9 months. That would have been the life that I would have wanted to lead. Yeah. And so for me, while this was not an enjoyable work, I understand why it's a classic and it's canonized because Juno Barnes went there.
She does bring out a lot of things that at the time would be literally considered shocking. Okay, so you have that theme, but then you also have the same-sex romance theme.
Yes.
And so you follow Robin. And Robin is, I would say, she's sort of like a passionate person. She finds passion where she can. And where she does, she doesn't just let it go. She tries to keep it all for herself, but that's not possible. You know, it's impossible for most people to be in love with one person, but then be running off in the middle of the night to be with another person. I think Robin would be happy in a polyamorous relationship. If back in the day she could have found one of those, she would have been fine. But she was falling in love with women that wanted to be exclusive, and she wasn't here for that.
I want to get into the fact that the other part of Robin that I noticed was her complete and total ability to capitalize on the opportunity in front of her. And the marriage to Felix was an opportunity. The relationship with, is it Nora Flood?
Yeah.
Was an opportunity. And then Jennifer comes along.
Yeah, she comes after she finally gets into a serious relationship with Nora. And then she goes off and finds Jennifer.
And so the thing that I think isn't shocking for me as a reader of this time, but that I think was shocking back then was not only did she write these same-sex relationships, but she wrote these imperfect same-sex relationships.
Yeah,
but why would they be perfect, right?
It's a very promiscuous, kind of way of being, and to the point where the promiscuity is not even acceptable to one of the characters, which is Nora. She just she's totally destroyed by it. But you have like 10 pages of Nora literally crying down the neck of,
the doctor
about how she did this and she did that and she wandered off and she isn't coming back. And I thought we were in love, and she's just going on and on and on and on.
So I want to say to readers here with regard those 10 pages. If you are a writer, I always come in with if you are a writer, if you are a writer and you are looking for dialogue exchange where there are two people who are completely and totally talking over each other, past each other, around each other, and making very salient points. Look at this conversation between Nora Flood and Matthew, who is the doctor.
It's very funny.
It is incredibly funny, and it's incredibly insightful. Yeah. And the thing that I find that's so funny is Nora has this complete and total line that she's taking. How could this happen to me? Why is this happening to me?
Exactly.
And here's this understanding that I seem to have about what happens to people in the night and how they transform. And the doctor is saying to her, BZ, that's life. Mm-hmm. Like, you ain't special. This is no new-ish.
Yeah.
Right? And essentially, to quote Shakespeare, what he is saying is, sometimes you get a raw deal. This is where the revelation of the doctor wanting to be a woman comes out. And he reveals that because he's dressed as a woman when Nora comes into his room. But he basically says to her, look, what Shakespeare says, men have died and worms have eaten their bones, but not for love. You will not die from this.
Yeah,
this is devastating.
That's how it is. Yeah.
And life, I would say that he extends that premise to life. Life gives you what it gives you, and you're not going to die over it. Now, how you decide to deal with it is up to you, and she's not there yet. She is not, and I don't know if she ever gets there, willing to hear that narrative.
No, she's
because she is so overwrought about the loss of Robin, who is basically the linchpin of most of the relationships. And I want to talk here now about structure and about what I said about how this book taught me more about my reading profile. In a lot of ways, I'm like, oh, I'm a little bit of a prude. This book was vulgar, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, the rope book of the ass one was pretty funny.
In my mind, I said to myself, I can be pretty coarse, like anybody who knows me in my daily life. But I was like, this book is a little too vulgar for me. There are a ton of, like, frankly, obscene references here. And I think some of it is very tongue-in-cheek. And I think
it is.
Some of it is again, a critique on society and the ways in which society can be priggish. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, I'm reading this book. And I'm like, I am priggish. I am society. I am being critiqued as this reader.
This book in particular, it's challenging because the structure of the novel isn't as evident as it appears to be.
For me, I would say that as much as I feel like readers should do work, I didn't want to take as much time as I had to take parsing the language. I actually don't think that the sentences didn't feed into the main point. But when the main point starts on the first sentence of page 8, and I have to follow you through page 9 for the digression that you take in order to then get back to make the point.
Yeah.
In the middle of page 9, for which you started in page 8, that's asking too much of me as a reader.
Because this happened more than once in the book.
I think it's her style.
That's it happened more than once, but I don't know if it's her style or if it's because of what she's writing about, she's trying to be cryptic about it.
I read it as her style. And I thought about this because, you know, Faulkner takes all these digressions all the time. And we just talked about Faulkner.
Yeah, but
last week.
He does it differently. I mean, you can clearly see what he's trying to do.
Well, for
unfamiliar territory to me. So I was like, what is she? Where is she going with this?
And so this is why I had to say to myself as a reader, if this was in territory that was more familiar to me, would these digressions seem less onerous?
Yeah.
And I think the answer might be yes, because Faulkner is talking about a peoples that I relate to. And so I'm willing to follow Faulkner down his rabbit hole. George Saunders, who's a modern writer, takes a ton of the regressions all the time, but the references are so familiar to me because he's writing about things that are literally a part of my daily life, that the insights gained on the route to the point that is being made.
I don't know.
It's something that I sit with. But with her, I had an impatience.
I don't know if you could compare it to what
I did, and I do. It's because I'm totally removed from the characters. So I will say this. This writing put me in mind of Ali Smith. Now, I know everybody loves Ali Smith.
God.
Well, not everybody. A lot of people love Ali Smith. And for those of you who love Ali Smith, you're going to have to come for me. I am one of those people who do not like Ali Smith. Every time I read an Ali Smith book, it is work. And sometimes I decide to do the work or I decide to do part of the work. And then I'm like, I'm not finishing this. But it made me think of that. I wouldn't reread a Juna Barnes book, probably. I think that it's a case for why every so often people should open up their literary lives to things that they may not enjoy, because everything is an experience. This was an experience that I did not enjoy. Will I do it again? No. Will I continue to read books that I don't enjoy to learn from them? Yes.
Wow. That's why we're here in the first place, right? To expand our reading life, you know? So it's a little book. It's a slim book. But some of the themes that she talks about are very important themes. They were important themes back in the 30s. And they're still important themes today. The idea of women's independence, let's just say independence even from traditional marriage, and what that means to be a woman who says with her chest out and beating it, I don't want to be married. Yes,
I don't want to be a mother. Job,
and no, I don't want to have any children. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. But this day and age, society is still judging women on how many kids they have, if they're married, et cetera, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, traditional marriage. And also with everything that comes with traditional marriage, this idea that freedom, as we know, freedom, but in this case, Robin, whose name is actually Robin Vote. I thought it was very interesting. She is going more for the freedom thing. She is finding love where she can. And when she does, she does not drop it. She grabs onto it and runs with it. And when that runs out for her, she'll walk out of the door and she'll find more love. And she'll run towards that as well. So she's a woman that's running towards her freedom. And it doesn't matter who doesn't like it, which I feel like in the 1930s must have been damn shocking.
We talked about these ideas of masks, and I would say Robin is impenetrable and unknowable, but the actions that she takes in this novel is not masked.
No, she's true to herself.
Yeah.
You know, she's the only character that's really true to herself. All of the other characters have some kind of something that they're hiding or that they're not being totally honest about. And that's when we see that in general, is that any different from what we're living today? Not really.
Well, that's what makes a classic a classic.
It seems like she's trying to hit on a lot of different points of the time period that were detrimental, you know.
That's why I liken her. That's why I liken her to Ali Smith, because Ali Smith does that.
Exactly. I mean, I've only read from Ali Smith. I read Spring and I just thought, oh my God, like, make it stop.
So what was the thing that you liked the most about this?
Well, there were two things. I thoroughly enjoyed the humor that appears throughout the book. It's funny. very funny at times. And I did enjoy the language, because the language is, it's quite flowery. It's almost musical to a certain extent.
When it hit, it hit. Like, it really hit.
Yeah, exactly. Because like there were some lines that I wrote down because I was like, oh, yeah. You know, it's like you couldn't argue with some of the things that were being said. And it really felt like you were getting that lesson on 1930s living that we don't have. We can only think about it and analyze it as an after effect because we didn't live that time period. And when you're reading this, you feel like you're getting the story, you know, you're getting the what's not good, what's not right kind of thing. So I think those two things, I think it was the flowery language and the humor is what I like the best. What about you?
So for me, I liked the ways in which the novel made me further see or further clarified some of the things that I think I instinctively knew or said I knew about myself as a reader, but then saw in action while reading this book.
I don't regret it because it's something that, like I said, I was never really pulled towards it, but I said eventually one day I should read that because it's supposed to be a classic. And so now I'm glad that I actually had a chance to read it and then discuss it with you. Because I mean, I was not alone.
I'm glad I read it. And I'm glad that even in the ways in which we didn't enjoy it, our takeaways were fruitful. So I'm glad we read it. And next,
yes,
we will be reading
Claude McKay's Romance in Marseille.
And I am quite excited about it. Every week I'm excited, right? So, but I'm pretty excited
about this Claude McKay because I haven't read any Claude McKay, you know?
I'm excited about it. I think I'm excited because I'm always interested in internationals in other countries. Hopefully you all will be tuning in to hear our thoughts on that book.
Yes.
So tune in next time.
Bye-bye.